This is the visitors Q&A 2020. It's the 8th of October. This is the first time we've done this, isn't it, John?
I believe so.
So I've got the page up, the visitors Q&A page, and we'll just work through the questions as best we can. John, you actually asked the first question on that thread.
Did I really?
Yeah.
Well, I do visit Nemeter now and then.
Glad to hear it. So first we'll go to Janie's question. Actually, this comes from another thread that she started called Sapphire in the Ukraine, and you can all go there, visitors, and have a look at that thread. She wanted you to elaborate, John, on the response that you gave her in that thread, which is, it is a significant conversation touching many points of passionate interest to me. Ever since I fell in love with Russian literature at the age of 16, I have expanded and deepened my investigation of that culture and race. There is much I might contribute to this thread, and I will see if I can eke out some time to do so in the future.
Well, this is a huge subject, and it would take quite a while for me to go over the many points of my passionate interest in Russia and the Russian people. So I'll see if I can summarize and go directly to my main concern, my main interest today in the Russian people. I read a lot of Russian literature when I was a teenager, and I continued my studies of Russia coming forward from the period of middle of the 19th century, the great early Russian novelists like Turgenev and Dostoevsky. And what really interested me, what really caught me in those studies, was that I perceived that there was some kind of deep struggle happening in the soul of the Russian people, which you might call the Russian folk soul. And I found this extremely interesting, because what was the struggle? What actually was going on in those people, such as you see reflected, for instance, in the works of Dostoevsky or of Tolstoy, and all of this in the pre-Soviet period. So I got involved in that. I got pulled into that very intensely during my teenage years, really. And then I continued to study it more deeply. And I would say the key figure that played a role in my investigation was this writer. Well, there were two writers. One was Vyacheslav Ivanov, I-V-A-N-O-V, and the other was Nikolai Berdyaev, who was sort of a newborn or reborn Gnostic. And when I read these two writers, Berdyaev and Ivanov, I really started to get the picture that later developed into a better picture. And I came to conclude that the presence of the Aeon Sophia was attempting to reveal itself to the Russian folk soul. That's how I would summarize what I discovered. And I hold by that view. I also hold by the view that one of the factors that was working behind the Soviet takeover of Tsarist Russia, it was not a Russian revolution of the people, but it was a takeover by the Bolsheviks of the Tsarist Empire and the looting of the Tsarist Empire. That Bolshevik takeover had a number of motives. One was the ideological revolutionary motive to bring communism into the world through conquering actually the biggest country in the world. But it also had a material motive, which was to loot the richness of the Russian upper class. And then it had a spiritual motive, which was to prevent the people from coming to that revelation of the divine Sophia, whom they recognized as Mother Russia. So they saw the image of her in the land of Russia. And Soloviev was the great mystic who set the mark for that recognition. So all of that's intensely interesting to me. But that goes back almost a century. What really interests me more today is just how not in his image and the Sovietic narrative could reach Russia. There is not yet a translation of that book into Russian. So I'm really intrigued by how it would play in Russia today, how the revival of the Sovietic presence and the Sovietic mythos would play in Russia today. So the final thing I might add is that I realize that there is a problem in Russia. There's a big issue between Ukraine and Russia. But that goes back to Stalin. And that goes back to the fact that the Bolsheviks starved out the Ukrainians in the Holodomor. And that's not the fault of the Russian people. But nevertheless, there is a...
resentment.
There's this huge resentment and a huge bone of grief between the Russians and the Ukrainians, because the Ukrainians, in their folk memory, remember what the Soviet Russians did to them. So I find it very intriguing that there is a folk revival and an indigenous revival in Ukraine. And that's great, and I support these indigenous revivals, a return to nature and to the fundamentals of life wherever they occur. That's part of the panic. What is it? The Pan-European Alliance of
National Indigenous Cultures.
Yeah. So that's part of the panic, and that's great. But my concern is, are they simply sentimentally and nostalgically reviving paganism, in quotes, or are they preparing an atmosphere that would be receptive to the narrative and to a Sovietic way of life? That's the question I hold when I look at what you are reporting to me about what's happening in Ukraine.
When I read those posts in that thread, what she described about the Ukrainian people being really connected to the earth, I see that more as a European thing, you know, window boxes, going out and foraging, looking for mushrooms that you can eat. That's just, to me, that's just a very European thing. I don't think I've been to a European country where they don't do that. So I don't think that necessarily denotes
it. It's not distinctive of anything particular arising there. I agree. It's true, all of European countries have that tendency, all the nations in their own way have that tendency to revert to nature. But the Sovietic way of life is not merely a reversion to nature in some kind of nostalgic replay of paganism. It's something much bigger. And I would love to see it rooted in Russia sooner or later, however that happens.
Next question is from Human Animal. 2 years ago, I was invited and participated in the first global public use of the Shakti Cluster app. His questions: are there results? Was the target properly buried? Is this all woo-woo, hoo-hoo?
So that refers to the Charlotte Working.
Okay. Yes.
Well, I've reflected a lot on the Charlotte Working since that happened in January of, 2018? And I consider, when I go back and I look at it, I always consider two factors. One factor is, what would have happened to me if it had worked? And what kind of attention would it have brought to me? Because if it had gotten out, that someone, and you know, weird things get out on the internet all the time. You know, it could have been on Reddit or something, who knows, right? If it had gotten out that someone who presumes or pretends to be practicing a form of magic actually put a spell on someone and it actually succeeded, not just on someone,
And would the media, the Jewish-controlled media, ever report it anyway? I mean, you know, I don't think... We have to refer to the target as she that shall not be named.
Right.
That's part of the ritual.
Right.
She that shall not be named doesn't even look like the first person that was supposed to be she will not be named. So they're always dragging out doubles. That person doesn't even write those books. We'd never know anyway if something like that succeeded.
Yeah, there were unknowns as we developed that ritual, going into it, doing it, and coming out of it. It was a tremendous learning curve. I mean, there were some astonishing things happened, and we were running on the ground trying to work out how the magic was operating as we were doing it. And of course, one of the problems that we considered at the beginning was, well, even if this works, how is it going to be confirmed, you know? And if it were confirmed, what kind of attention would that bring to me, you see? And if it did succeed, but it was impossible to confirm it, then what kind of dilemma is that? So we looked at all those angles. So basically, at the end of the day, I would say that it is impossible to determine with 100% certainty whether it actually worked or not in terms of taking out
that specific target. Yeah.
But the other part of it is that it produced the third nail. And as far as I'm concerned, the appearance of the third nail, which is inexplicable, was the response to the Charlotte working that came from the Aeon Sophia, who was commanded, who would be the commanding force in that operation.
And who chose the TI.
So I take it that according to her way of handling things, she delivered the result of the Charlotte working in the third nail, which is now being used. Shaktas are now using the third nail for other strikes.
And we've got a good result from the first one already. So.
And we seem to be getting quite good results from it.
I would like to add something. There were so many factors. You've said human animal, is this all woo-woo, hoo-hoo? Yeah, some of it is. Inexplicable things that went on around that ritual for months after. We've sat and talked about this. There's recordings of it somewhere. If I can find them in Nemata, I will post them in response to your answer. You can go and listen to them, because you do say at the bottom, Nemata is so packed, dense and wordy, I really don't know where to look. And I totally understand that. So if I can find the talks, I think they're in there somewhere, I'll post them in response to your question on this thread.
We kept a meticulous record of it every step along the way, and that wasn't easy, I can tell you. And in response to the question of woo-woo, no one is more cautious about the woo-woo factor than I am. And I can tell you that Gayan Tantric magic is something that's in the making. It's something that's been introduced and is in the course of being tested and perfected. And there's a really fine edge when you practice with the Shakti cluster, when you, the practitioner, must hone your skill so that you know that you are right on a razor's edge between pretending and make-believe and real magic. So real magic does exist, but you have to experiment rigorously with it to know what is real and to know how to perform it.
Because our concept of what magic is has been totally polluted by Hollywood, Disney,
and
television.
And She Who Must Not Be Named was one of the greatest polluters of the concept of magic. Mm.
So Human Animal has quite a few questions. Where may I find a succinct summary of the historical narrative that could easily be handed in pamphlet form to my Christian cult friends and family?
Historical narrative of Christianity?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, if you're saying Christian cult friends, I can answer that. I would say go to Thomas Dalton, PhD. He does Holocaust in 60 seconds. He's published a Christianity, the Great Jewish Hoax. But I think if you're going to give it to Christian friends, you've got to red pill them about the JQ first before you start on the Christian, unless they're going to read Not in His Image.
Which is unlikely, perhaps. There's more to that question, isn't there?
To make the most sense of all the main characters in the Christian narrative would be successfully recontextualized and formatted into the correct narrative. The Christ character, for example, was he someone else? Did the Arcanists invent him from thin air?
This is something that you don't want to do. Don't even get involved. It's not worth your time, and it's too complicated. I've tried to show that the files that come from Christianity regarding the role of these key players, the role of the so-called Christ, the role of Satan, the role of Lucifer, these are all corrupted files. So if you want to talk to your Christian cult friends, the first thing you need to do is totally clear your mind of those corrupted files, and then talk to them from a viewpoint which is entirely free of their brainwashing. And then you can approach them in a really direct way. But don't get involved in the script and the narrative. I mean, I covered it in Gnostic Sabotage. I covered it in the talks on the Great Deception. That's the best that I can do. It's not worth thinking about who the Christ was. All you have to know is that...
He was a rabbi, a Jewish rabbi.
Yeah,
that's all
was
you need
he
to
a Jewish
know.
Rabbi? Was he an extraterrestrial? Was he a Venusian that landed in flying saucer? Was he a Gnostic? Was he an 8-foot-tall purple rabbit?
Was he a white European Aryan?
Yeah, was he an Aryan? It's not worth going into any of these scenarios. All you need to know is that Christ figure is an icon, is a deceiving icon of your own humanity that has been planted in your mind by the Zenosh.
John Ward has a question. Do you think the many Bible predictions, etc., have been created or manipulated to set up a script or narrative to subliminally NLP us so that our intent is stolen, so to speak, and directed and used against us unknowingly?
The way I regard biblical predictions is that they all derive from a primary assumption on the part of people who give them any credit. I give them absolutely no credit at all. But on those who do give them credit, among those, you'll find Christians, of course, Christian fanatics, that they are all operating on the same premise regarding their definition of God. So they define God according to the Old Testament standard, which, of course, comes from the Zenosh. And according to that standard, God is omniscient and knows everything. So that means that God already knows the outcome of things. So that means that a prophet like Ezekiel or Daniel is simply someone who glimpses the mind of God and sees what the outcome will be and then makes a prediction. It's just like in horse races. They see what the outcome will be, and then the prediction is simply explaining the outcome that they see. But who can see?
It's hedge funding, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like hedge funds.
It's totally Zenosh.
So who can see? It's all those predictions are ultimately based on the assumption that there are prophets, mainly the Old Testament prophets, who could see the mind of God. And because God sees everything, they could then predict what's going to happen. That premise is entirely false. The true gods, the aeons, are not omniscient. They do not predict and foresee and predetermine everything that's going to happen. So in the illuminated or liberated mindset of Gnosis, you completely discard the notion of prediction. So there's been enormous amount of brainwashing that comes out of the Old Testament and out of the Zenosh narrative of the Talmud and the Torah and the Old Testament.
And the New Testament.
And the New Testament and the biblical prophets. And all of that brainwashing belongs to the same program, which is a program to control the human races by lording it over them as a super race who knows the beginning, the middle, and the end of the game. And it's all bullshit. It's all complete hype.
John Ward actually expanded a bit on this question. So he was talking about how the Zenosh, both directly and indirectly, use sly trickery with words. So, for example, the Australian Premier, Dan Andrews, was telling everyone that they had to grass on their friends and family to the authorities that anybody that was disagreeing with the Koyid narrative, and they're looking to legally make it law an offence to be a conspiracy theorist. So they turn the offence into offence. O-F-F-E-N-C-E to O-F-F-E-N-S-E.
I see. They turn the offence into the offence. Well, I'm aware of what's happening in Australia, and obviously it's a beta run for the full Soviet system. And typical of the Soviet system under Stalin was the surveillance and every citizen spying on everyone else. And they're trying to bring that in now. And that's part of the paranoia of Zenosh. They need to have everyone reporting to them on anything that might threaten their game. And they're going to push it as far as they can. And it's not going to work. It's just against human nature. It's against human honesty and decency and respect to be a rat and snitch on people around you. But that's what the Zenosh need for their program to succeed. But I don't see it happening. I see it driving people back to the question of basic honesty and respect for each other. And that's where they will take their stand, and that will be the true offense.
Next question is from Wilfred. Actually, he's got quite a few very interesting questions, so I'm going to do my best to read them succinctly. One, could you give some insight into the terminology and technical concepts that have to be known to you to what level before that very same term can be used in the instruction coming from VV to you in order to have a shared vocabulary. For example, when VV taught that nous is nucleic acid or that the material archontic virus entered the vector group via a variant of L-DOPA, were you already familiar with those technical terms before the instruction? Or can new, yet unheard of, terminology and concepts be introduced during the instruction?
Well, that's a really good question. First of all, if you're going to do a telestic session and you're bringing a question to the light, which is, of course, the method, just want to make the question as simple and direct as possible. For instance, you could say, take argon, for instance. Argon is a constituent of the atmosphere. It's more preponderant than CO2. So you already know about argon. And so you could pose a question to her about argon, something you want to know about argon. And in that way, she would respond based on you already knowing something about argon. So it can work that way if the question contains an item that you already know something about. But likewise, it's very typical to get intel about things that you don't know anything about before. So, for instance, the intel about the archonic infection in the racial vector, the tribe, being concealed behind El Dopa. Well, I didn't really know very much about El Dopa when I got that intel. So if she answers with a technical item, as she sometimes does, that you've never heard of before, then you go and investigate and find out what you can about it. But you don't have to have a lot of technical jargon in asking her questions. Her responses can be extremely technical, and they can bring up things that you're going to have to go and investigate in order to confirm the answer that you're getting. But the basic rule is, when you ask a question, don't be so concerned about the jargon. Be more concerned about the question being simple and explicit. And then you have a better chance of getting a response that you can handle.
I think, because I know, Wilfred, that you've put a post up about getting people together to do telestic shamanism, and I think that's wonderful. I think, having experienced these telestic sessions with you, John, myself, I think you really need to keep your training wheels on before you go and ask any kind of question. Just encounter her. That's the first mountain to climb in a telestic session, just to encounter her.
And hold it.
Yeah.
Being able to hold it is not easy, because it's just overwhelming and obliterating.
And the
power of her presence is so beautiful that it knocks you right off your feet, really.
And, you've got to know what you're looking for. I've had John there in my telestic sessions, to guide the, steady the ride and guide the ride. And, I used to sit there with my mouth open at you, because we'd be in the rush and you'd be speaking so coherently. And I'm thinking, I don't know how you can even speak at the moment. So
it would be wise. I do intend to respond closely to your initiative to do a telestic session. And so in our conversation, which may be a verbal conversation at some point, preparing for that event, I would perhaps give you some parameters for an introductory telestic session.
And I'll just say it now while I remember, it's better, I would say, for a neophyte, if they're going to ask a question, to put it in this way: show me.
Yeah.
Show me.
Show me syntax.
Yeah.
Is a good way to start. So it's really important to me. I'm very grateful that you're undertaking this, by the way, and that you're doing it with the parameters of planetary tantra in mind, that is to say, do it correctly. So I do make myself available whatever way I can orient you to that event.
Okay, Wilfred's next question. What would you like to say to the world if you had 10 minutes to live and you had a microphone shoved in your hand?
All right. Well, as I consider that question, I'm going to put it in a specific situation. So let's say I have 10 minutes in the current situation, which is the COVID-19 PSYOP. So I would address humanity with reference to the clear and present danger of the PSYOP. And I would say that there are only two kinds of people in the world. One kind tells you how you must live, and with the intention of forcing upon you their concept and their program for how you must live. And the other kind, which is my kind, are the people who tell you how they live, and then you can handle it. And you can relate to them based on them telling you how they live. They don't tell you how you are going to live. They simply tell you how they live. So the situation today that's coming to crisis, which I would compare to the lancing of a horrific abscess on the soul of humanity. The situation today is one in which people who are telling you and I how we must live and how we're going to live are billionaires. They're billionaires and they're heads of great organizations which have glorious names, three-letter names, like NWO and WHO. And all of these agencies, all of these organizations, all of these NGOs, all of these enormous humanitarian programs are all run by psychopaths who have millions and billions of dollars. And those are the people who are telling you how you're going to live. And the way to change that game is to turn it around and tell them how they're going to live. That's the way to change the game. To talk back to them, including, by the way, this is really important, the transhumanists. We know that comes from the Zadokim and the Zenosh. So the transhumanists like Elon Musk and all these other people who are promoting robotics and the merging of IT with the human animal, all of these people are billionaires and millionaires, and they're heads of great organizations which pretend to be operating on plans for universal rights and the betterment of humanity. Those claims immediately identify these people as the ultimate enemies of humanity. They're your enemies. And the way you talk to the enemy is you tell them how they're going to live. And you tell them, first of all, they're lucky. They'll be lucky if they are able to live. But if they are able to live and continue to live in correction or after correction, they can only live as pariahs and outcasts who have been stripped of absolutely everything that they have, materially speaking. And that's what I say. I say, if I had 10 minutes to speak, I would say, go for the throat. Take them out. But know who the enemy is. They are the humanitarians. They are the defenders of universal human rights. And they are the ones who target the white race for genocide. All the races, really. But the white race has to be in the bullseye, because unless they take down the white race, they can't take down anything else.
Well, that's miscegenation, isn't it? You know, you can't get rid of a whole race of people, the white people, by mixing them with other races without also getting rid of the other races to mix in the first place.
It's like a palette of colors in which you mix all the colors together and you end up with a shitty brown. So that's what I would say. I would make a declaration of war. And I would say, it's really easy to see who the enemies are. The head of the IMF, Klaus Schwab, who's promoting the program of the Great Reset. You don't have to wonder who the enemies are. Anybody who has billions and billions of dollars and all the privilege and influence and power that comes with it lives in the delusion that due to having that, they are entitled to tell everyone else on the planet how they're going to live and how they must live. And they're absolutely wrong about that. And it's about time someone told them so and took them out. And they have to be taken out because they will not give up their power and their money voluntarily.
Next question from Wilfred. Is the screenplay of Sabine Spielrein in some way available or accessible?
Well, I've sent it around to a few people to read, but I only send it to people who are not just interested in reading it for its entertainment value.
So it's not an emitter and it wasn't on meta history?
No, it's not.
Okay, question four. Regarding the FGS 1.5, in episode 7 in the terms section, you said, quotes, fires needle frequencies, shortwave radiations that operate in a tight directional path, such as radar. He says, shouldn't this be the Archon's or the Demiurge's needle point? As in the episode itself, the following is mentioned regarding the needle. The monster focuses the radar emission into a needle-shot beam that sweeps around in a great circle. It lacks the organs of a living creature, yet the monster sees with a scanning beam as it sees though it is blind.
Right. Well, that's pretty complicated, and I'm not sure about what I was intending when I used the reference to needle when I was writing that.
That was the most intense, 8 weeks? 7 weeks, something like that.
It was a tough haul getting through
it.
That
was
one.
Really tough for you and anyone that was around you. It was really hard.
So what comes to mind now is the expression of the needle-like frequencies. The Archons are, in reality, an alien paranormal species that inhabits the solar system. And their technique... Among their techniques for intruding upon humanity over countless millennia was the technique of needle-like shortwave radiation blasting upon the Earth. So they used that to break down and break into the human mind, but they have been impeded from doing that for 6 years now. So since October and September of 2014... The Aeon Sophia has shielded the Earth from that assault of needle-like microwave radiation. So due to that, the game of the Archon proxies who are living with us and living among us, the Archonic psychopath zombies, is breaking down. They don't have the backup that they used to have that numbs the human mind. So... The problem today is to deal with those psychopaths and the technology that they have. Now, it's possible that they have tools or weapons, guns, and scopes and various devices in which they can concentrate needle rays of 5G or EMF, and kill and harm people. It's possible that they have that. And it's possible that they may pull out those weapons as they get very, very desperate, as the COVID psyop falls apart. But I can't speculate on that. A lot of what is said about 5G and archonic weaponry, I consider to be overhyped fear-mongering. So it remains to be seen. If they use those weapons, with certain... Observers will certainly know that they're doing so, and we will deal with it at the time it happens.
I'm going to go back and look at the FGS he's talking about, the episode, because I see what he means in the terms. It possibly could mean Sophia's needle frequencies. I mean, the Archon...
I don't know what Sophia's needle frequencies are.
Okay, I'm going to go back and look at that, and we'll check that out. So, next question from Wilfred. How did you get the first mutation figure, which was 2.4 billion iterations, with the Mandelbrot seahorse set he hasn't been able to find?
I just had to go and look that up on the internet. It's in a book called Turbulent Mirror by John Briggs. It's an excellent book on complexity theory. And in that book, he shows the image of the seahorse embryos that appear at 2.4 million or billion iterations of the Mandelbrot set. That's where I found it. Excellent book.
Next question. Could you describe the process of retrieving the additional intel and fleshing out of those 9 episodes? What state of mind were you in? Was it the same as getting the download for the Terma of Gaia Awakening? No, he wasn't in a telestic trance when he was doing it.
No, something worse. Something stranger. Yeah, that's a really good question. I would have to ask myself that question. I need to ask myself that question.
You were pushing your limits as a mythologist, but as a creative mythologist.
Well, you know, I've spoken of this faculty called the NPU.
Non plus ultra.
The non plus ultra, which is the power of description. And so that's a capacity that is inherent to the human animal. It is in our endowment. And it's the ability to describe. So I would say that during the time I wrote those episodes, I was navigating, maybe at moments I was stranded, between the experience of having the DI or the Gnostic Intel being on live stream with the Gnostic Intel, and then on the other hand, having the power of description that was adequate to putting it into the story in a way that worked and in a way that was coherent, not cumbersome, not too complicated. So I was between those two powers. Now, of course, there's a certain element of constant DI. Every time you go back to the narrative, in a sense, and you repeat it and reread it, you are, in a way, in DI. So I was in DI, but at the same time, I had to access my own capacity for the non plus ultra in order to translate and convert that intel into a form that was receivable, you see. And that was in certain respects, and at certain moments, that was not so easy to do.
No, it's a really intense time creating that whole thing. I mean, you were doing all the work, obviously. I was just house cleaning behind you, but it was so intense. I've said it flippantly, but it did almost kill you.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
No, but I'm dramatic. I'm a woman.
All right, I'll accept that.
I said that to people who know you intimately. It's nearly killed him.
No, no, no risk of my life. But I have to say that this is physical.
It was a marathon. It was a marathon, wasn't it?
It's a marathon, and it was like a physical run, like I was a long-distance runner. And there were moments when I was staggering. I was literally staggering around the house. Mm. I would walk upstairs, walk up the hallway to get some coffee, and I'd bump against the walls of the hall because I was staggering under the physical intensity of putting it together.
Mm. Last question from Wilfred. These are great questions, by the way. It's regarding myth. Do you know of specific myths in which the very phenomenon of lightning and or electricity is mentioned?
No, I can't say that I do. Now, you can find in comparative mythology any number of thunder and lightning gods in different cultures or races. Like Thor, obviously, is the thunder lightning god of the Scandinavians. Tengri is the thunder-lightning god of the Mongolians, the thunderbird of the Native American Indians. Now, there are many, many examples. I can't cite off the top of my head any of the anecdotes or narratives associated with thunder gods that would have revealed some specifics of the physics of electricity or lightning. I can't, but it's possible that if you went back into that material and brought that question to the material and read it closely, you might be able to find some of that kind of intel encoded in those myths. possibly. As we're going over the questions, the subject of Walter Russell comes up, and I did respond to that in the thread, so you can go back and read what I said. Lately, I've had occasion to think about Russell's physics and his metaphysics due to the totally fresh and stunning intel that is coming about electricity and light. So electricity is the breathing of the aeons. Light is the gaze of the aeons. And there's a whole physics of light and electricity coming into definition now. And in that respect, I would say that in some instances, Walter Russell was on the money. He did hit it. But in other instances, he totally missed it. So I would be very cautious about an uncritical immersion in the work of Walter Russell. It needs a lot of sorting out.
But that the recent intel on electricity is in the biomysticism course.
Yes, and it's coming up. Also, I'd like to just point out one of the glaring problems with Walter Russell that I picked up on. His book on light has a master diagram. Perhaps you've seen it, and it shows, it's like a full page, and it shows this connection of the different planes of existence and the different modifications of the primal light source. And in that diagram, he names different physical elements, such as hydrogen, helium, oxygen, and so forth. And it so happens that exactly in the middle of the diagram, at the center point, is argon. However, if you scan through his book correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you scan through his book, that primary text on Russell, he doesn't say anything about argon. So argon is a tremendously important element in Gaian physics, and there are things to be said about it. So that's just one example where you can't really rely on Russell for a complete and coherent system.
To be fair to Wilfred, he did go on later to say that he's going back into Walter Russell, he was reminded that there was something amiss and, you know, the underlying religiosity.
Very paternal.
A strange coldness and reductionist point of view, among other things.
Right, it doesn't have the thrill and the beauty and the eroticism of the Sophianic physics. Not by a long shot.
Next question from John Ward. John, I just listened to your excellent talk on ideation, and whilst listening, many moments in my life came to mind when I was daydreaming about nothing, or so I was told from a young age and so thought it was so. These moments were blank to me, and since I first heard about you and then read Not in His Image 6 years ago, I've noticed that if I randomly slip into these daydream-type states, I would shake myself out of them because I started to feel that I was being manipulated to be so. So my questions are these daydream states where one just stares without thinking ideations? If so, then is it to be mindful literally what it implies?
All right. It occurs to me we might have a slight issue here because the talk on ideation is actually in a members section, right?
Yeah, it's in Breaking News. It's the Shodashi Shift,
right.
2020.
Anyway, I think the subject of ideation is one to which everyone can relate. It refers to those moments when you can see, for instance, with someone else, if you're sitting with someone else and you can see that they're sort of looking into space.
Glazed.
In a sort of a glazed way. And what you will observe is that they are actually thinking about something and their mind is racing, but they don't really know what they're thinking about. So I discussed this issue of ideation and how dangerous it can be and also how to snap out of it. So yes, what you describe as reverie or blind daydreaming is ideation or a form of ideation, and mindfulness is the skill of attending to your own mind that allows you to see that you're in ideation and to snap out of it. Because being in ideation is a way of running your rigpa, or your faculty of attention, just into a rut. It makes you dull when you indulge in ideation. So yes, the primary act of mindfulness is to be able to detect that you're in ideation. Okay?
And the last question we have, so this is someone called Sean Loftus. I'm not going to read the whole thing out, but basically he was listening to one of the Radio Guinan broadcasts, and you, John, commented how on the Gnostic works and Nag Hammadi, but nobody is producing, anyone that's speaking or writing about those works is not producing original work. So his question is, is there going to be a special course dedicated to the Nag Hammadi literature? Has the school ever considered a standalone course on the Nag Hammadi literature where you run through, present and explain each of the chapters from a Gnostic standpoint?
Well, I have written commentaries on the Nag Hammadi codices, and the basic program that I used was to take, I think, 36 or 32 out of the 52, because some of them are completely negligible. So I have written about half of that. I've covered about half of them, and those commentaries belong to Gnosis Today. Is that a course in Nemeta?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, they're in Gnosis Today. And also, I would very much like to see those commentaries, if I manage to complete them, produced in two volumes, one as a book. One volume is already ready to go into book form. And there would be two volumes to cover the ones that I have selected that are worth commenting on.
Yeah, you've got a block in Gnosis Today. You've got a block called the Nag Hammadi Library Commentaries, and you've got 9 units in there. So there's already 9 lessons in the school.
That's a lot. And believe me, those 9 is a lot to chew on. So I'm really happy with that work. I'm quite proud of the way that I handled those materials. There's an enormous amount to be learned from them. It's not everybody's cup of tea, obviously, you know, and there are some people that I wouldn't advise, that I would advise not to go back and dig into all that material. You could compare it to the foundations of a house that are sunk into the ground and hidden. So when you're in the house and you're enjoying the stability and the structure of the house, you don't necessarily have to go down into the cellar and look at the foundations of the house. But I realize that some of you would be attracted to that, and so there it is, and it's already there. Not completed, but about 60-65% of it is done.
As somebody that catalogued the Ambergain Library, your personal library, so I've gone through every single book by hand, and so I went through all the Gnostic material, and I saw the Ambergain Library when it was out in Ambergain House. It was on the shelves. I mean, I think you've covered all the material that's worth covering.
Yeah, the Gnostic Hermetic Library was in one corner there, by the off the left to the French doors, and they're talking about 85 books. Mm. By Gnostic scholars, Dead Sea Scroll scholars, the Hermetica, everything essentially that anyone needs. But again, as you often hear people say when they review movies on the internet, I watched it so you didn't have to. You're welcome to go back there, and the commentaries are there, but it's not everyone's cup of tea, and it's not necessary.
No, I think Sean's basically asking what you say about the Nag Hammadi Library to be made available for a special course. I think that was the
it is a course.
Crux of his question.
It's
yes,
already
it is.
In Gnosis today.
Yeah. Okay, that's it then.
Wonderful. Well, until the next time, we sign off.